Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we begin with a story that could only be told in Chicago. I mean, the headline really is the story, but of course it speaks to so much more. Chicago man robbed by three men, then shot by three other men.
Oh.
Robbed by three men and shot by three other men. This is a bad day in Chicago, I suppose, but it does take a village to rob and pillage. This CBS2 reporting here. This guy lives over at Presidential Towers, apparently. He's heading home to Presidential Towers. He's approached by three men in the 500 block of West Madison. One of them pulls a gun on this 52-year-old dude, told him to hand over his wallet. And then at that moment, three men in a sedan pull up, get out of the car, open fire on the victim and the three men who were trying to rob him.
Okay.
So the guy they were trying to rob also got shot. I mean, it's not funny, but it's just, you cannot, I mean, you know.
You can't make this stuff up.
I mean, it's Monty Python quality here in terms of the anarchy in Chicago and Blue City America more generally. The shooters got away.
Oh, shocker. Let me guess, they were on electronic monitoring?
We don't know because they're still
in the lam.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And police working with Presidential Towers and to get surveillance video to see if they can identify these goofballs, thugs, goons, predators, and pull them together. Victim shot in his lower back. 19 shell casings recovered at the scene. One of the bullets shattered a nearby window. That's just another happy afternoon in the city of Chicago. I mean, Presidential Towers is not that far west.
No, it's not.
You're really moving the west side pretty close to the city center, if you want to call that the west side.
And anyone sending their kids to Lollapalooza, you better think twice. I mean, I got in a huge argument with my friend because he's sending his daughter there. And I said, are you crazy? Why would you do that? And he said, well, they have metal detectors, Amy, on the outside, so no one's going to get shot. I said, I wouldn't worry about that. Going to and going from. And people, they're just randomly, indiscriminately shooting. They might just be on the outskirts of it and shooting, you know, from Lakeshore Drive, and a bullet could get into Lollapalooza.
Well,
he took me to task for that, was upset. And I said, well, it's not a safe. He goes, were you worried about COVID? I go, COVID's not going to kill people. Gun violence has killed more children in this city than COVID. 27 kids dead, three from COVID.
And, you know, Lori Lightfoot, Mayor Triple Threat there, she gave this interview to New York Times podcast that was released on Monday. We talked about a bit. But she said of the crime in Chicago and the search, all roads lead to COVID. Why do I think this is happening in this moment here in Chicago and perhaps also across the country? Perhaps. To me, all roads lead to COVID. When you think about public safety is really an ecosystem. Public safety isn't just cops on beats, meaning police officers occupying spaces in high crime areas across the city. Every part of the public safety ecosystem was crushed by COVID. Our county partners, the prosecutor, the courts, the jail, similarly retreated. Our Cook County court system for criminal trials still hasn't fully reopened 16 months later. Mm-hmm. All roads lead to COVID. Is that right? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. All roads lead to COVID.
No, that's just her scapegoat. That's why they keep it going. That's why they keep, you know, teasing us. Like, oh, the mask mandates are right around the corner. You know, because they're taking the focus off the real problem, which is violence in Chicago. It's like a Democratic politician's playbook. That's what she has going. And anybody, we have to see through this bull jive.
Well, first of all, we've seen surges like this previously.
Right.
We saw them under previous mayor, Tiny Dancer, most notably. It wasn't that long ago, not that so distant in our memory. Secondly, it's interesting. So on the one hand, you're a COVIDian lockdowner. And on the other hand, all roads lead to COVID. So first of all, she's wrong on the substance that all roads lead to COVID with respect to crime spikes in Chicago and other blue cities that have embraced anarchy. She's wrong on the facts. We talked to Zaid Jilani about that. The data is very interesting. Just one data point to underscore it. Last year, Mexico saw a 0.4% decline in homicides year over year. You know, cartel land. Right. They saw their homicides year over year go down by half a percentage point, while Chicago and so many other blue cities that have embraced anarchy were up 30, 40, and 50%. So something else going on. It's not COVID.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 646-36. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And secondarily, if it was COVID, I mean, you know, part of this complaining about the courts and this blame shifting that is always attempted. Yeah, sure, if you just want to look at it in isolation. But you're a proponent of all the policies that led to these shutdowns. So this is, you know, we were hapless against this virus. There was little we could do other than what we did. We did the best we could to save lives. Meanwhile, we were losing lives because we turned over the cities to the thugs. And that this doesn't even, you know, contemplate everything else we've talked about in terms of the lives versus lives trade-offs with right. mental health and death, other deaths of despair and so forth. But just that alone. So let me understand something. You shut down and boarded up and told to shelter in place, shelter in home, to save lives, particularly the underserved black and brown community in Chicago. Meanwhile, you turn the streets over to the thugs of the city and largely, overwhelmingly, disproportionately victimized black and brown people in the city of Chicago. Square the circle for me. How's this policy working? All roads lead to COVID. And again, this is not unique to Triple Threat, but she's one of the worst examples. Perhaps the other worst example is Bill de Blasio, Mayor Warren Wilhelm, the outgoing mayor of New York City. I wish we could say the outgoing mayor, Triple Threat of Chicago. On his way out the door, he's all of a sudden focused on improving quality of life.
Oh, really? Is he now?
He's focusing on quality of life issues. He's rediscovered the broken windows theory of public safety. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. He was talking about the illegal drinking, pot smoking, other behavior that's contributed to the mayhem in Washington Square Park. And he said, you know, there's more to do in making sure we set the right parameters. But right now, our focus has been on bringing the city back, addressing the more serious concerns. And more, we're starting to be able to focus on the quality of life concerns as well. Mm. Now, of course, in typical fashion, he's got it in reverse. You do the little things to set a culture that prevents, discourages, disincentivizes some of the big things in terms of lawlessness. And he's going to try to do the big things, so he says, while ignoring the little things. He's got the order reversed if he wants to be a broken windows acolyte. But it's just interesting that this is even reaching the imperious and the lame duck like a de Blasio. And you know why? Is because Democrat socialists are reading the tea leaves and they see that the lawlessness in big cities.
It's not working for their Democratic Party.
That's right. And remember, the electorate is not just contained to the corporate boundaries of these big blue cities that are lost. The real audience is always the suburbs because the suburbs support the city and the suburbs sort of identify culturally with the city, particularly those that are the champagne socialist pea hat wearing types, that characterize themselves as, you know, the regional elders, the enlightened class in a particular geographic. And so that's who it's not working for. And if it's not working for those pea hats, then it's not going to be working for Democrat socialists at the polls. And they're starting to realize that. And the combination of blaming COVID as a way as exculpatory evidence for the crime, you know, they're really running out of excuses, it would seem to me. Well, and that's the good news. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app.
Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Yeah, that's right. Remembering Dusty Hill, he of ZZ Top, a bassist that died at the age of 72 yesterday. All morning, taking your instant request for your favorite ZZ Top songs, one of the great bands of all time, but particularly the 80s.
Yeah, and his family announced it on social media, but did not give a cause of death. But yeah, he was 72 years old. Oh, that beard, huh? What do you think was inside there?
Well, him and Billy Gibbons. But yeah, that Eliminator album. I mean, once you heard Eliminator, you were a ZZ Top fan if you like music.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Nancy Pelosi gave a wonderful insight into her philosophical view of the world, deep as it is. It can all be summed up in terms of how to address man's problems. All be summed up in one single word.
What?
Philosopher Nancy Pelosi.
I said earlier in my comment, science, 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 and science. On almost every subject that you can name, science is the answer. Whether it's the climate crisis, whether it's a health crisis, whether it's our preeminence in the world in technology, science, 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 science. To say that wearing a mask is not based on science, I think, is not wise. And that was my comment. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Oh, is she? That's all.
That's all I was going to say about that. Science, science, science. Is that right? Science is the answer to all that ails man. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And to her point about the science and mask wearing, it is worth noting that the CDC is not making available the science and data that allegedly drove their decision to make the recommendation that was announced the other day.
Really?
Because being men and women of science in 21st century America, at least of a particular disposition, particular viewpoint, means never having to show your work, which, of course, is a real hallmark of science. You don't have to show your work. You just declare something is because you say so. You make generic references to science and data as the basis of a policy recommendation. Of course, that's how it is now. And what do you get from the Speaker of the House? Science, science, science. As if, again, science is a single answer. Science is a tangible thing as opposed to a process. But science, 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 it's the answer to all man's ills. Not to try to one-up such a philosopher as Nancy Pelosi, but G.K. Chesterton was one of many who has something to say about this tension between science and its limitations when it comes to how to organize a society. He was fond of saying, science can analyze a pork chop, can tell you how much of it is phosphorus, how much of it is protein. But what science can't analyze is man's wish for a pork chop.
Oh.
And this is what Nancy Pelosi and the rest of the Democrat socialists, these neo-Jacobins, get wrong. Of course they get it wrong because they're not interested in getting it right. They're here to perfect humanity in their image. We were created in Nancy Pelosi's image, you understand, and the image of her fellow ideological travelers. She's going to perfect us. And you know how you perfect people? Through science and technology. Kent in Aurora, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, folks. Maybe more clever people can make this better, but, you know, science is only one letter away from silence.
That's good.
Thanks, Kent. Chip in St. Charles.
Did science tell Nancy Pelosi that killing a child in the womb is killing a person?
Right. Thanks for the call, Chip. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy, and thank you much for taking my call. Listen, this Democrat Party is basically, they're destroying the science society, if you will. And I mean, just like they destroyed the educational system and everything, they've got and Pelosi feels that she's got enough political hack scientists that can back her up and everything like that and lie and scheme and everything like that. There's no science in her. They're just political, rotten people and everything like that, using science, in quotes, and everything to take and move their agenda. Sick.
Thanks for the call, Craig.
I mean, people are so pro-mask in Chicago. Did you hear this? The LGBTQ plus community is demanding that Mayor Lightfoot and Dr. Awardi require masks at the Haymarket Days, which are taking place next week. Because they're so afraid that even though they're outside, they're so afraid that they want they're begging like on their knees saying, please mask us. Please make everybody wear a mask.
Mm-hmm.
And they want crowd limits, and they want everybody masked outside for Haymarket Days.
Representative Tim Ryan, who once upon a time challenged Nancy Pelosi for the speakership, this tells you a little bit about where the Democrat Socialist Party is today. Tim Ryan, who challenged Nancy Pelosi to her speakership once upon a time, Democrat from Ohio, who fancies himself sort of a common sense, union supporting Democrat, and he's not. He's just another goon, and he's another facile. He's another infantilized legislator, offered this on the House floor about masks yesterday, admonishing his colleagues, starting with Kevin McCarthy.
Fear, fear, fear. Look, the attending physician of the United States Capitol, the top doctor for Congress, asked us to put on masks when we come to a chamber with 435 people. I hate these things. Absolutely. It was terrible having to put this back on. And we do it because the top doctor for all of us asked us to. And I may not be from a hot spot. Speaker may not be from a hot spot. Speaker Pelosi may not be from a hot spot. Somebody in this chamber is coming from a hot spot. Somebody represents the hot spots. And they get in a plane, and they fly here, and they interact with all of us. And then we leave here, and we go home to our families. Some take care of their sick parents. Some take care of kids who may have an autoimmune disorder. And I just find it absolutely immature and appalling to somehow diminish it to try to score cheap political points.
Is that what's happening? You know, the safetyism is a manifestation of the science, 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 to borrow from the great philosopher Nancy Pelosi. It's trying to score cheap political points by questioning masks. Mm-hmm.
Masks don't work. They don't.
The hot spots.
The hot spots, yeah.
The hot spots are all around. You never know where a hot spot is.
Yeah, but I mean, a hot spot is if you go from zero cases to two. That's a hot spot because cases doubled.
The sophistry that you heard from Tim Ryan is what we've heard from the beginning. To question is to kill grandma and grandpa. And you lay out these fantastical scenarios whereby you get on a plane and you're around all kinds of people. Then you come to Congress and I get exposed to you. Then I go home and I'm taking care of my fictional son with an autoimmune disorder and I kill him. That's the basis on which you want to make public policy for 330 million people.
There's other viruses too that you could take home to grandma and grandpa.
Of course there are.
Right.
And if they're not vaccinated by now, sorry. There are other viruses that you can get and you take, you know, forgetting that are more dangerous to children, too, by the way, specifically, since not everybody's in the same boat, like the flu.
Higher mortality rate for children for the flu than for COVID. But nobody talks about that.
Well, we talk about it, but nobody seems to care, at least not so much that they're not wooed. Not nobody, but half the country doesn't seem to care so much that they're not wooed by Tim Ryan's sophistry. And so here again, you're going to manage the exposure for everyone, not high-risk individuals, for everyone. That's what you're intent on doing. Of course they are, because you heard it from Nancy Pelosi. We're here to perfect humanity for you. It's very nice of them. Derek on 355.
Yeah, I was just calling in to see if there was an answer to science for Nancy Pelosi's husband buying about $15 million in green stocks before Joe Biden signed all the green energy bills and the executive orders.
Yes. Thanks for the call, Derek. Yes. I'm sure it was all based on the charts and the graphs that he was examining, science and data. You know, the science of economics and the data of him being a keen observer of the marketplace. I'm certain. Diane in Buffalo Grove.
Hi. As we know, there is a definition of science, is that it is repeatable process throughout the world, space, and time right now. So the repeatable process in Texas versus South Dakota, Nancy, doesn't exist because the science won't, to Amy's point about statistics, come close in these various neighborhoods across our country.
Thanks for the call, Diane. Pat in Lockport.
Yes, good morning. I had read about a study that was done in one of the cities down in Florida where they took masks, clean masks that children had put on in the morning, and after 5 to 8 hours, they put these masks under microscope. The pathogens that were on there were absolutely incredible.
Yeah, we discussed that.
You're talking
that.
About pneumonia, right. Tuberculosis. Hold on a second. Now, you wouldn't wipe your backside with that mask, let alone put it on a child's face. And I defy anybody to show me the efficacy of masks on the CDC or anywhere else. They're not there because they don't exist. And furthermore, if your savior is your mask, there's no way in hell I can make you sick no matter what I have. Savior died and rose. Mine is not a vaccine or a mask. You guys have a great day.
Thanks for the call,
Pat.
Yeah, and we went through that, and that's part of it. I mean, you raise a good point, too. So even the studies that look at this that are inconclusive at best about mask wearing, you know, there are certain assumptions that are made. One of the assumptions is, to Pat's point, you're wearing a clean mask that's properly fitted, that's over your nose all the time, so on and so forth. And that's just not how it actually operates in the real world if you've ever been to an airport or if you've been to an airport during COVID, for example.
Or to a school or where kids are playing sports and they're sweating so much that the masks aren't over their nose. They're not. Why even bother wearing one? I mean, when E. coli was on that, there's a whole long list. I tweeted it out of what was found on those kids' masks. They started in the morning. They picked up the masks at 5 o'clock at night. And again, they were all brand new clean masks that day, and these are what they found on those masks. It's disgusting. That's why people got bacterial pneumonia, an alarming rate this year, because of wearing dirty masks.
Tim in Woodstock.
Morning, Dan and Amy. Somebody just said that science is something like a hill that scientists are climbing, and when they get to the top of that hill, you know, they find the theologians who've been sitting there for centuries. I don't know if anybody picked it up, but she went from saying that science is the basis for making all decisions in life, and her next sentence said something like, "I don't think it's wise." And I thought, what are you talking about? You know, Nancy, those two don't go together. Science can lead you to the point where you have to apply some wisdom to life, but then it switches over to what is wise. And I, you know, I'm sure nobody in that room that day caught that inconsistency, but it was obvious.
Thanks for the call, Tim. You know, the other thing, too, in terms of the effort to get compliance, to minimize the pushback, did you catch what CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said about the new mask guidance from her agency? The big concern is the next variant that might emerge. Just a few mutations potentially away could evade our vaccines. So now by the way, she's also said in an interview with a European media outlet that vaccine passports may be a thing again.
Oh, really?
So
who's going to sign up for that? And this is what, the Epsilon and the Lambda?
Well, yeah. The point here is I'm trying to follow the logic here. So get vaccinated and then now wear a mask even if you're vaccinated, because the mask will prevent transmission, and the prevention of transmission will reduce the possibility or the likelihood of mutations that could evade the vaccines and make all of what we've done over the last 16 months irrelevant. Is that what we're to believe? Okay. If that's the logical thread, then show me the science and data. Oh, right. The CDC doesn't have to present any. Kathy in Orland Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. You know, I noticed that when you talk about the mask, you found all those, that bacteria and everything on the mask. But it did not seem if it's on the inside or the outside. If it's on the outside of the mask, it's actually protecting kids. And really, when I heard you talking about tuberculosis, that's huge. I mean, if the mask does prevent that child or that person from being exposed to tuberculosis, that's pretty amazing because there are strains of tuberculosis that are incurable.
I thought it was on the inside of the mask.
Well, wait a second.
I never heard it say inside or outside.
How is mask wearing all of the sudden, as of the spring of last year, preventing the spread of tuberculosis in children? What spreads the preventive?
It isn't.
I don't know if it is, but I'm
saying that fact that you found tuberculosis, even if it's on the outside of the mask, it's pretty amazing. But the problem is not wearing masks correctly, you know, and touching the outside of the mask.
Yeah, well, the problem, thanks for the call, Kathy, the problem is thinking that masks are...
The problem is masks don't work. It's a false sense of security.
A force field. Okay. The problem is thinking, to the point about evidence of TB, is thinking that we're going to eliminate the existence of COVID, as opposed to, for example, with the TB shot, right? That's how you're immunizing children from TB, isn't it? It seems like we've forgotten everything we understand about dealing with previous viruses, as well as living in a world of trade-offs. That we've certainly forgot. We didn't used to forget that when we talked about having to deal with a public health issue. Chuck in Gray's Lake.
Morning. I just wanted to mention that, you know, when we hear about these people talking about science, you should remember that it was the Germans in the early part of the 20th century that were really the leaders in science, and look where that brought them by the 40s.
Thanks for the call, Chuck. I mean, here's the, and again, go back to Chesterton. I concede, not the philosopher that Nancy Pelosi is, but Chesterton, all science, even the divine science, is a sublime detective story. Only it's not set out to detect why a man is dead, but the darker secret of why he is alive. Another question we are no longer contemplating in the era of science and safety as I'm brought to you by COVIDians. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A couple of weeks ago, we referenced this piece in The New Yorker, New York Magazine. New York Magazine, left outlet. This rare admission from the left about the situation with kids in school and COVID. Quoting from the piece, among children, the mortality risk from COVID-19 is actually lower than from the flu. The risk of severe disease or hospitalization is about the same. It has been known to be true since the various earliest days of the pandemic. And it's still true. And now we're at the cusp of masks back on, and the next step, and it's just a baby one for COVIDians, is school is out.
Honestly, when I woke up this morning, my heart sank. We cannot go through this again. We can't. And you know what's going to happen here in Chicago. Because of Lollapalooza, we have 100,000 people coming here a day. So just take 400,000 people, maybe 30% have been vaccinated, but in order to get in, you have to be tested. So they set up all these testing sites around Lollapalooza, including Dan, where you live in Lake Point Towers. I had a long line there yesterday on the first floor there. Long line of people getting tested. So people from around the country and around the world are getting tested. That is, if they're positive, it's going to come back as an Illinois positive test. See what I'm saying? So that's going to add to our case count. And then the teachers, CTU Teachers Union is going to see that. They're going to freak out. And then they're going to not go back to school because they are looking for something. Do you understand? They need something to protest. And if those numbers go up, because we had Lollapalooza, because it starts today, that our kids are going to pay the price for them being greedy and having Lollapalooza go on.
Oh, no, no. The Chicago Teachers Union is at the forefront of the fight. Educators, this is their tweet. Okay. Educators fighting for more resources in a district with $2 billion in federal funding. That's 90% black and brown. Students struggling to survive and recover from a pandemic and nearly 200 shootings of children under the age of 17. How dare we demand more money? They said in response to criticism of how much per pupil spending has gone up in CPS. How dare we ask for more money against the backdrop of students struggling to survive and recover from a pandemic, plus nearly 200 shootings of children under the age of 17 in Chicago this year, noting that Chicago public school per pupil spending has increased by a third in the last 3 years, from $20,000 to $27,000 per pupil. And they want more.
And they want more, yeah.
And they want more.
Their piece of their pie.
And they want more raises. because of course they're only concerned about the kids recovering from COVID, right, and from 200 shootings of kids under the age of 17. That's where CPS is, and CTU, because CTU and CPS are the same thing. So we've known this since the beginning, the threat posed to children. We know it to continue to be the case today. And here's what else we know, something else we've known from the beginning from studies earlier, but just another one for the science and data people. McKinsey and Company, that's a renowned consultancy, released a study looking at test results from the spring of this year for 1.6 million students in grades 1 through 6 across America. Then they compare their performance this spring with that of similar students pre-pandemic. They discover that the pandemic-era children, and by the way, this is going to be the COVID generation, isn't it?
Yep.
The pandemic-era children were on average about 4 months behind in reading and 5 months behind in math, and that's the most optimistic scenario. 4 months behind in reading, 5 months behind in math. Also, the study also found children in majority black schools ended the school year a full 6 months behind in math and reading. Students in schools where the average household income was below $25,000 were 7 months behind in math and reading. There was 7 months behind in math and 6 months behind in reading. McKinsey noting students who move on to the next grade unprepared are missing key building blocks of knowledge that are necessary for success. Oh, you don't say. Of course, a lot of parents are paying for tutors or private school, but those under $25,000 and many others, just even at upper income, incomes higher than that, can't afford that. And they certainly can't afford it when you have, say, in Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer vetoing legislation that would provide funding for scholarship funding, essentially, grant funding for parents to hire tutors, in addition to, of course, the teachers' union's general opposition to opportunity scholarships to bring competition to K through 12. So, I mean, there was a Brown University study in the spring of last year that suggested what happened, that numbers similar last year, just in losing the spring semester of 2020. Now you're a full
year and a half into this, Dan.
Right.
And our kids went back for, 12 flipping days.
And again, four months behind in reading and math, that's the best scenario. That's not including kids that were remote for a above median period of time nationally, which will be worse. And it also doesn't really get the compounding effect of losing the spring semester of last year plus the last year of school for so many kids. And so you're going to just pass them along, and every big city school system will more closely mirror the Baltimore school system, where, you know, to have a 0.9 GPA is to be in the upper half of the class. And we'll just keep passing you along, and then you'll get out of high school unable to be self-sufficient, and then we'll move you over to the welfare state, or you can move yourself into a life of criminal activity.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. So if you have school-aged kids that live in a blue state, what Hot Air wrote, that you're courting disaster by not moving before the fall semester. I want to move so badly.
Government schools, at least. And some private schools, too. There's a really good piece in the Washington Free Beacon, you know, why so many private schools are mirror images of the public schools in terms of culture. They reference this annual conference of for New York City private schools on diversity, equity, and inclusion that was hosted by the Dalton School, which we've talked about, one of the bad actors. Rodney Glasgow delivered the keynote address. He's a school administrator who's founded multiple DIE consultancies, diversity, inclusion, equity. He used the opportunity to characterize parents who are opposed to the anti-racist curriculum at Dalton School and elsewhere around the country, the racist curriculum. He said they were like white supremacists who stormed the Capitol, and that schools that admitted their children were like the Capitol police officers who opened the gate. There's no truer metaphor for independent schools than that moment on January 6th, Glasgow told the attendees. When will we stop hiring the people on the inside who are opening the gate? This guy, Glasgow, has held multiple positions with the National Association of Independent Schools, which sets accreditation standards for a group of more than 1,600 American private schools, including the country's most elite secondary schools, like Dalton. The association keeps a list of approved accreditors and outlines principles of good practice that it expects schools to enforce in order to gain accreditation. And, of course, part of that is enforcing DIE, diversity, inclusion, and equity, DIE, anti-intellectual claptrap, racist demagoguery. Yeah. So, and by the way, that's just on the critical race theory front. They're behaving the same way on the COVIDian front as well, so many of them, for the same reasons, because it's ideological. Is that not clear? Is it not clear that the COVIDians are ideologues? And so this helps explain why government schools, particularly in urban centers, are a catastrophe. But a lot of these elite private schools are no better. They just look better because of the families and the kids that are represented. But make no mistake about it, if you don't hew to the orthodoxy, they don't want you there. Rodney Glasgow said so at that conference in no uncertain terms. And so this is the extortion game they play. You want that Dalton School credential, don't you? Well, then you better shut up and let us indoctrinate your kid if you want that credential. Same thing that happened at college campuses starting 50 years ago. And people are just sort of, so many people just taking notice of it now. So where to send your kid to school? Better be very, very surgical about it.
Well, my cousin's still homeschooling because they're back to mask mandates in Nevada. So she said, I'm going to do it again.
Well, that's one option, no question. Or you better do education at home as well as whatever happens in the school. So you're sending a kid to whatever school they're going to, ready to do battle, intellectual battle. Yeah. John and Alsip, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. Thanks for taking my call. We just need to just be done with all of this. I would rather my kid not be educated than be taught with this and have to apologize to his black student classmates for being white. And we need to just man up and teach our kids at home. I don't care what it costs. I'm going to teach my kid proper math, proper writing, proper reading, and be done with it.
Thanks for the call, John. Appreciate it. Richard in Blue Island.
Hey, Dan and Amy. I think, you know, you should play the song by Alice Cooper, School's Out, you know, every day until school opens again. School's out, you know, for summer.
For summer.
School's out completely.
The perpetual summer, yes. All right, thanks for the call, Richard. Put that on the hit list.
Yeah,
Tom
Justin's all over it.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know, I'm so fortunate that my kids are out of the grade schools, but my son just finished the bar exam yesterday for 2 days, and of course, he had to do it on Zoom, which is ridiculous. And so this is affecting every level of education. I mean, look, he's taking a bar exam in a bedroom in our house on a Wi-Fi that if it goes bad, he's kicked out of the class. He can't go to the bathroom for 6 hours. He can't even he can't move his face away from the screen. Yet on campus, and I'll say it, out at Northern, there's plenty of room out there for them to sit 50 feet apart to do this. And it is ridiculous. And I'll tell you, the quality of education that the kids are getting is so poor. Like your last caller said, I think it's at a point where you just keep them out of school. I'd rather have them not learn what they're teaching in these schools than just not learn anything at this point. Just
yeah.
Teach them yourselves.
I'm sorry.
It's gotten so bad.
No, I'm sorry. It's terrible. I'm sorry what happened to your son. They drove him to become a lawyer. That's how bad it is.
Well, I'll tell you. Dan, I'm a contractor, and people always say, you know, there's too many of guys like myself. And I tell my kids, yes, but there's always room for good ones.
Absolutely.
And same thing with attorneys, doctors. If you're good at what you do and you have good morals and ethics and you're driven, there's always room for another one. I believe that.
Thanks for the call, Tom. I agree with you, of course. Lucy in Elmwood Park. Hi, Lucy.
Hey, Lucy. Lucy.
Good morning.
Oh, there you are. Hi, Lucy.
Oh, so my question is this. Science is so important. All the politicians, CDC, say science is so important. Well, wasn't lobotomies considered sciencely right during the 50s and 60s? So why don't we just go back to lobotomies?
It'd be a nicer way to go through this world at present, wouldn't it? Thanks.
Yeah,
thanks for the
Dan,
call. Remove my frontal lobe, please.
Dan, you could do
thanks
it live
the
on
call,
the air
Lucy.
In the studio here. You can just remove my frontal lobe if I even have one left.
Yeah, no, I know. And, you know, and send the leeches over to Simone Biles to help her excise them, the evil spirits that are polluting her brain, right? There has been some stops and starts with science over the
science evolves
annals of human history, haven't there? Mm-hmm.
Kennedy did it to their daughter.
Chris and Carrie.
Hey, good morning, guys. I called in yesterday and told you about sending the D26 board meeting, which is the elementary school board in my district, and how they walked in with masks, and they ultimately decided that they were going to have masks mandate throughout the school year. Well, at least they didn't say throughout the school year, but we later got them saying they visited until there's a vaccination for 12 and under. Encouraged D-155, which is the high school. Last night's meeting, they all walked in without masks, and they decided to keep the optional choice. So,
that's good.
Half of my kids are happy, and the other half not so happy. I wish we'd have some consistency. I mean, it's the same town, but we can't even get any consistency.
Very interesting. Thanks for the call, Chris. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Our ZZ Top tribute continues on the unfortunate news of the passing of bassist Dusty Hill. And I think that's why I liked him, because that blues influence in their rock and roll.
My favorite song is Pearl Necklace. It's about the Republican Party, the women of the Republican Party who wear not one strand, but sometimes three strands of pearls.
Is that what it's about?
Well, yeah, because they're from Texas. I'm sure you know. They're Republicans. Yeah.
That's what it's about.
That's what it's about.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I had a different interpretation, but never mind.
We'll play that one later.
Yeah. Southern Illinois University down there in Carbondale is launching a doctoral program for equity and social justice in education. Perfect.
Oh, God.
SIU down there. Well,
Salukis, way to
Carbondale.
Go.
These are not necessarily college towns. So, yeah, Southern Illinois is conservative, but not. There are pockets of neo-Jacobinism, and, of course, SIU is one of them. Yeah. In response to the university's drive towards solving DEI issues, diversity, inclusion, equity. And that's the way it should be said. It's DEI, but go with DEI. Let's try and popularize that. The program will prepare scholars to address structural inequities in educational settings and devise and assess programs and practices that can lead to improved educational outcomes. And when you get that PhD in DEI from SIU, you can take it over to Kroger's and become a shelf stocker, if you're lucky, if you pass their practicum. Kroger grocery stores, they have a 24-page, I want to.
Don't create more homework when you don't have to.
Well, I don't want to, you know, hyperbolize the issue. 24-page guide on how to be a woke cashier and shelf stocker. Their LGBTQ plus allyship guide. Mm-hmm. Our goal is to ensure that all LGBTQ plus people are treated as full and equal across our company. We champion a more inclusive culture. We continue to partnership to leverage our influence to drive positive impact. It's all the Orwellian newspeak that you've become used to from identitarians. Partner with leadership, leverage our influence, drive positive impact. And by the way, how do you know who's LGBTQ plus? I guess they're, I mean, you can't ask.
No.
You're not stereotyping, are you? Perhaps they're just out and proud, as of course they should be. Within the Kroger family of companies, we embrace diversity and inclusion as core values. We're proud to have been named one of the best places to work by the Human Rights Campaign for the third consecutive year. It's quite an honor.
Did they have a parade for them?
Their values, integrity, honesty, respect, safety, diversity, inclusion, those corporate values. And they've got definitions here for your use, non-binary, intersex, cisgender, pansexual, gender identity, just in general, queer, transgender, you know, the whole thing. It's nice. Probably a laminated card form so people can carry it around with them. Then they have a page in this guide on gender spectrum. There's many dimensions. Everyone's different. You know, there's all the way on one end from women to gender queer in the middle to man on the other side.
Groceries. Do you talk to your cashiers when you go to the grocery store?
About my sexuality? You're damn right I do.
I mean, they're ringing up your groceries, plastic or paper, and then you go on your way. I mean, I'm nice, and of course I'm like, how are you? Are you having a good day? And thank you, blah, blah, blah. But I don't talk about, hey, do you know that my son's friend may be transitioning? I mean, what is wrong with these people?
Well, let me make it real for you.
Okay, please.
All right.
Are we going to do a hypothetical?
We'll do a little role play.
Okay.
Do a little role play.
All right.
All right, you be the cashier.
All right, fine.
I'm the customer. Yeah. I say, can I have a cup of coffee? And you say...
What
do you say?
I'm not selling coffee right now.
What's a cup of coffee?
Oh.
Let's say you're selling coffee. Can I have a cup of coffee?
Say, what kind? Would you like an espresso? Would you like a decaf?
I just want black coffee.
All right. Would you like a large
or a small? Oh, see, you did it.
What?
You did it.
What did I do? That's what I... You asked for a cup of coffee, and I want to know what size. You want a large, medium, or small?
Excuse me. You
what?
Said sir. And that makes it, that's making an assumption that I'm a man. Now.
All right, let's try it. Hey, you, what do you want?
No.
All right, what am I supposed to do?
The right way to do it, can I have a cup of coffee? You say, yes, I'd be happy to get that for you. Rather than saying, yes, sir, which assumes that I'm a man. And you can't go around making those kinds of assumptions.
I'm showing respect to my elders.
Customer arrives to the store, and I say, good morning, ma'am. What have I done wrong?
Oh, there you go. Done it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
In a healthcare setting, referring to a waiting patient, the lady in room one is ready. Oh, no. The patient in room. Do you see how that's more inclusive and tolerant? I mean, you can't just refer to me as a man.
We're changing our society for 1% of the population, not even 1%.
Mm-hmm. Also, something else for that's lamination worthy. Put that in a card in your wallet next to your vaccination card. Notable awareness dates that you'll want to take notice of for celebratory purposes. This is in the Kroger LGBTQ plus allyship guide for those aspiring to be a cashier at a Kroger grocery store. International Transgender Day of Visibility. Oh, man, that was a great March. That was a great March 3rd we had.
What was Transgender Day?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to write these down.
I am. I'm trying to. International Transgender Day of Diversity?
Yeah, that's March 3rd. Then, you know, when you recover for that after a couple of months, May 17th is International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia.
Okay.
May 24th, the following week, Pansexual Visibility Day.
Okay.
Of course, June is Pride Month, but it should be every day. July 14th is International Non-Binary People's Day.
Okay.
We have Bisexual Awareness Day. We have National Coming Out Day. We have Spirit Day, which is anti-bullying. We have Transparent Day, which is the first Sunday in November. We have Transgender Awareness Week, which is the second week of November. We have Transgender Day of Remembrance, which is November 20th.
Mm-hmm. What's in December?
I think that December is a day or a month of rest after all of the celebrating and the remembering and the observing. You know, I used to like it when corporate America would just pay extortion money to racketeers like Jesse Jackson.
Yeah,
you know, just back in the day, the good old days where I get it. I get the hustle. You're a shakedown artist. We don't want the headache. You know, here's 50 grand to Rainbow Push to go away so you can have your convention where you invite Stacey Abrams and Tony Fauci to speak. Oh, yeah. No, they're coming to town, by the way.
What?
Well, they're coming to Zoom. Yeah. The Rainbow Push annual convention, the theme this year, Beyond Freedom to Equality, Leveling the Playing Field in the Era of COVID. Ooh, that should be spirited. It starts this Sunday. And it will include Tony Fauci, Ben Crump, Stacey Abrams, some of the featured speakers.
Oh, my God, they're a traveling show now?
Well, it's Zoom.
Yeah, because, you know, you don't want to catch the vid or something.
And the convention concludes August 5th. The convention, I guess, begins August 5th and goes to that. Oh, so it's the following Sunday. Kicks off the convention August 5th. I had my scheduling wrong. Sorry. With a video of Jesse Jackson receiving the Legion of Honor, France's highest honor, on July 19th in Paris from French President Emmanuel Macron. I didn't know he received the Legion of Honor.
Wow, I didn't know.
July 19th. Yeah, he received the Legion of Honor, Jesse Jackson, for being one of the great shakedown artists of the last 100 years. Congratulations. And it's great that Tony Fauci and Stacey Abrams are making time to address the Rainbow Push Coalition. But, I mean, I don't want you to think that that means Tony Fauci has any ideological perspective.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a political person at all.
But, I mean, that was the good old days, the Rainbow Push heyday, when it was just an extortion racket.
Kind of like what Michael Avenatti did?
Well, yeah, although not quite as effectively, clearly. But now it's Kroger engaged in their own extortion racket. They sort of internalized the shakedown artists, haven't they? They just shake down, well, in some cases, depending on their rent-seeking behavior, the federal government or state governments. They're just shaking down American culture more generally. It's sort of the same racket. They've just internalized the modus operandi of Jesse Jackson. Isn't that interesting?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
John in Franklin Park, here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I mean, this is clearly a solution looking for a problem. I mean, how many people have actually been damaged and there's been a court case because they were called him or her and, you know, they want to be called something else? This is absolutely ridiculous. And I say that we have a protest day, August 1st. We go into Kroger, and everybody demand they want to be called peanut butter and jelly.
Okay. I don't know. I might be in preparation for buy something day or whatever. But okay, yeah, all right. Well, so you know, because of this is the corporate culture, and now it's becoming American culture at the hands of academia and corporate America, of course, the DC press corps. It's nice when somebody pushes back against one of these emissaries of nonsense, one of these neo-Jacobins. And so Tom Cotton did that recently. He had the vice president for human rights at Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has a vice president for human rights? That in and of itself tells you about all you need to know. His name is Paul Lally. And Tom Cotton had this exchange with Mr. Lally, if I can assume he's a man, about Coke's disposition towards the state of Georgia versus the state of China.
Mr. Lally, for instance, you were asked if Coca-Cola would call for the IOC to delay the Chinese Olympics, to give a chance for them to be rebid or for China to stop its genocide against its own people. And you said that Coca-Cola, quote, I think this is your exact words, quote, doesn't have a say, end quote. So can you tell me why Coca-Cola doesn't have a say in whether it sponsors the genocide Olympics next year, but it does have a say in how the state of Georgia runs its election laws?
Senator, what I stated was that we do not have a say in the selection of the host city, nor on whether an Olympics is postponed or relocated.
So you don't, but you could just make a statement. Your CEO could saddle up the same moral high horse that he got on when Georgia passed its election law and write a letter to the IOC and ask them to. Anybody can do that. If he's an American citizen, that's his rights under our Constitution.
As I stated, we are most engaged on policy issues here at home, but we are clear in our respect for human rights globally.
Can you explain to me why James Quincy will not denounce a democratically elected legislature's laws, but he will not simply say that the IOC should consider rebidding its Olympics or that Coca-Cola should consider sponsoring the genocide Olympics? What's the difference there?
Our role as a sponsor is to support and follow the athletes.
So you're sponsoring the genocide Olympics. You are spending millions of dollars to sponsor the genocide Olympics, yet you will not opine on any matter about it, yet you will stick your nose in the Georgia legislature's election reform laws. Can you explain to me the contrast?
First, let me say that we do not make decisions on these host locations. We support and follow the athletes wherever they compete.
Yeah, no, I've heard your talking points, and I'm tired of hearing them, Mr. Lally. I'm asking you a simple question. Why is it that Coca-Cola will opine on Georgia's election laws, but not on the genocide Olympics?
As I stated, Georgia is our home. It's where many of our employees live and work, and we are most engaged on public policy issues here in the U.S.
I think the answer is you're afraid of the Chinese Communist Party. You're afraid of what they will do to your company if you say a single word, like, for instance, saying that both the Biden and the Trump administration are correct when they say that China is committing a genocide against its own.
It's such an instructive exchange, number one, just because it's nice to see somebody get raked over the coals who richly deserves to be raked over the coals for the nonsense that they're spewing. And that would be that Coke vice president for human rights, Coca-Cola generally. But it's just really instructive. Look, the moral high ground you claim where it's easy to claim, or you create moral high ground that's easy to claim and then push it and impose it on your employees and, you know, as many other people as you can, because you have allies there. You know, the allies are fewer, the consequences more real when you're going to get about criticizing the Chinese communists and you're a corporate interest with big money at stake in China. I mean, it really exposes how feeble these executives are, including that guy that was before Tom Cotton, as a representative of Coke, and how feeble it is, how pathetic they are. They only speak where there is no, in terms of taking any position, where there is no risk of repercussion, where they can roll over people like their employees who have to suffer through the Kroger 24-page LGBTQ plus allyship indoctrination. And you were to applaud, or these companies get applauded on Twitter and by the media and so on and so forth, because there's no consequence. But it doesn't make what they're doing right. In fact, it's quite the opposite, isn't it? Isn't it the case that these are people doing bad things under the cover of newspeak, under the cover of the left's political talking points? They're otherwise moral cowards, not moral leaders.
Trying to be loved. Hey, Larry.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Are we going to cancel Mother's Day and Father's Day now?
Yeah.
And call it Parenting Day?
They call it the person who raised me day. In most cases, it would be the babysitter. But, you know, Mariano's now is owned by Kroger, too. So if you go in Mariano's, I guess they got to treat you the same way when you go in there.
I guess. Thanks for the color. Yeah, I don't know. I don't grocery shop, but so I guess the people that do will have to tell us what the experience is. The frontline employees. I mean, all this talk about frontline employees at grocery stores being heroes. They are, not because they did their jobs during COVID, but because they can endure this 24 pages of nonsense from Kroger, I suppose. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Dan Henninger writing in the Wall Street Journal about Joe Biden and his falling poll numbers. In the here and now, this is what the average American sees. Unpoliced urban crime, a non-existent southern border, rampant homelessness, the Delta variant and vaccination hesitancy, federal confusion about who should wear masks when or where, store owners telling customers that workers prefer the Biden stay-at-home federal payments, and prices going up. Even for FDR, that would be a heavy lift. And you can only get away with what's happening in the country, in people's everyday lives, by offering sanitized teleprompter PAP for so long. And the so long may be running out on Joe Biden. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Roger Kimball, editor of the New Criterion. Roger, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yep. Happy to be with you guys.
Henninger offers a fairly good summary of what the average American sees, if they're to believe their own lying eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, it's I was talking to a friend yesterday about an old TV show called Howdy Doody, which was a kind of a mannequin manipulated by somebody. And Joe Biden has always impressed me as being a lot like that Howdy Doody mannequin. He's sort of a puppet. How is it possible that someone who barely emerged from his basement for the entire campaign should have received 80 million votes? I don't believe it. A lot of people don't believe it. It's he's a kind of manufactured puppet doll that is being foisted off on the American people as president. And the work of the committee behind Joe Biden is a pretty radical left-wing agenda, isn't it? As you mentioned, the border, or the lack of border. We have tens of thousands of people streaming across our southern border. What happened under the Trump administration? Illegal immigration had been slowed almost to a standstill. Now it's totally reversed. We have huge inflation, and just yesterday, I think the Federal Reserve Chairman said, this inflation is going to be quite a bit worse and more long-lasting than we could have predicted. Well, I think if you spend trillions and trillions of dollars that you don't have, you can expect inflation. And people are beginning to wake up to it. What will happen? That's a very good question. We have elections coming up in 2022. I think we'll see a a kind of repeat of 1994, when there will be a, you know, a huge swing in the House, and probably the Republicans will also take back the Senate at that point, even though it's, you know, any more Democratic seats are up this time. It's a strange moment to be in. To be in this country, the rapidity with which things have changed is kind of shocking. And then you add to all of that the activities of these institutions that people used to have great faith in, like the FBI. Today, as it happens, is the 25th anniversary of the bombing in Atlanta, where the FBI fingered a guy called Richard Jewell. Yeah. Turned out he was innocent, but they destroyed his life. You know, more recently, we've had the Russia collusion delusion. Then we had, you know, this the Governor Whitmer kidnapping plot. Turns out, and it looks as though the FBI not only had informants there, they hatched the plot.
Yep. Well, is anybody going to get fired for that? I mean, is American people going to know the truth about that?
No, of course not. I mean, what happened to James Comey? He's, you know, cashing his plump royalty checks. What happened to Andrew McCabe? What happened to you know, the lovebirds, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page? Nothing. What happened to the chap, I think his name was Kevin Kleinsmith? He actually changed an email, inserted the word "not." So it was Carter Page and a CIA asset? Yes, he was, said this email. He inserted the word "not" in order to get a FISA warrant on Carter Page. That is to say, to use the intelligence apparatus of the United States, designed to, you know, look outwards to foreign enemies, to use that to spy on the Trump campaign in order to affect an election. It was, I mean, it's breathtaking.
Well, what happened
to him? He got probation.
Yeah, what happened to Peter Strzok? He got a gig at Georgetown. I mean, what happened to Louis Free, speaking of Richard Jewell? What happened to Bob Mueller, speaking of the anthrax?
Very good question. These are all very good questions. That's, so it's not surprising that this once admired institution is now not admired.
And with respect to what you saw yesterday or the other day from the January 6th star chamber that Nancy Pelosi has put together. I mean, do you see that as an act of desperation by congressional Democrat socialists per the midterm elections? Or is this just a manifestation of their continued purge, regardless of their majority or minority status? The only thing that that will determine is the pace of it.
Yes, well, the more we know about January 6th, the worse it looks. It clearly was not an insurrection. The Capitol was open. Why didn't Pelosi ask for? Why didn't she call the National Guard, for example? I mean, the more you learn, the more you understand that in fact the FBI and other agencies were part of this plot, and it's quite extraordinary. And the extent to which, I mean, 400 people have been arrested. Scores, I think, are in solitary confinement. Whatever happened to your constitutionally protected right to a speedy trial? And what are these people? What are they charged with? Very vague, you know, conspiracy and so on. In many cases, they just happen to wander into the Capitol. It's hard to know when this story will be told.
Well, in some cases, they were escorted by Capitol Police.
That's right.
What's the play here, though? What's the play behind this commission?
It's a continuation of this insane. It's more than anti-Trump. I mean, because, you know, Donald Trump is now off the stage, but it's an anti-populist effort to, you know, play politics. And, what Nancy Pelosi and her confrere are doing is deeply troubling. It is politics, but it's you know, I'm glad that Republicans have decided to pull out, because they, you know,
most of them.
Yeah, most of them. Well, all the real Republicans.
Those are, yeah.
I mean, you have Liz Cheney, who's, you know, represents, I think, Georgetown. But it's an extraordinary thing that we're witnessing, and it will be hard to assess it until we see how everything plays out.
Are you surprised by this latest iteration of COVID Redux, the CDC's reversal on mask wearing, and the pending vaccine mandates, not just from corporate America, but also the federal government?
Am I surprised? Not really. I mean, it's been pretty clear for a long time that, the whole COVID panic is, again, it's partly a matter of social control. It has very little to do with the disease, and everything to do with the ability of state, local, federal authorities to control our lives. I mean, what masks, the kind of masks that you see people wear, basically do nothing. It's these little paper face diapers that we're enjoined to wear in public transport and so on. It's just a kind of virtue signaling. And, you know, the Delta variant, it sounds scary, like the Andromeda strain or something. But if you look at the numbers, the number of deaths has gone way, way, way down. And it's just, you know, it's more communicable. But so what? That's the way viruses work. Viruses mutate. And this is a seasonal respiratory virus. How many people died from the flu last year? Well, according to Scientific American, 700. Usually it's 30, 40,000. So as I like to quip, you know, the great thing about COVID is that it's abolished death from old age.
And Roger, that's good. I'm sorry for that.
From anything but COVID. Yeah, go ahead.
No, and what's Dr. Fauci's role in all of this?
That's a very good question. I mean, it would be interesting to have the documents subpoenaed, the NIH documents and all the entities that work for the NIH. Why were U.S. taxpayers funding gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Virology Institute? That's a question that we don't have answered yet. He denies it, but we know from the people there that, in fact, we funded that. And what is gain-of-function research? Is how do you manipulate a virus to make it, you know, more communicable, more deadly, to make it infect humans that where it had only infected animals previously? It's a kind of, you know, bioweaponization. Why were Americans funding this research in this Chinese virology lab? We don't have an answer to that, but we do know that Anthony Fauci, he was the head of this organization. It's a lot of unanswered questions, and I'm glad that Rand Paul is on the case with Anthony Fauci.
He is Roger Kimball, editor at the New Criterion. Roger, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yes, my pleasure.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
I'm not going to ask you to tell us what that is referencing again, Amy. Dan and
Why?
Amy, and according to the CDC guidance, three-quarters of Illinois counties are now considered areas of high or substantial transmission where masks are suggested indoors, even for the vaccinated. That would include in the Chicago area, DuPage, McHenry, and Will.
Yeah, Will County is considering masking up again indoors.
Great.
They actually passed something
DuPage
last night.
DuPage and McHenry. Hey,
yeah.
they're in the same boat.
I mean, are people honestly going to go for this? Are you ready for round three of this madness?
I don't know. The question is, what will the reaction be? I mean, there are some interesting reactions from, you know, basically some erstwhile defenders of the status quo and of the state, and that would include the goofy mad money Jim Cramer. He went off on a bit of a rant.
Yeah, during a stock market breakdown on Wednesday, he didn't hold back what he thinks about this new guidelines from the CDC.
I ordered 10 boxes of N95s. You have to do that. Not the KN, by the way. That's not doing the job. You have to wear the N. And I haven't been this frightened since the beginning of the pandemic. So I thank you, CDC, for making us feel like if we go outside our house, once again, we are at risk. And because of you, we're having a down market. So thanks for nothing. But our CDC, our NIH, sorry, Dr. Fauci, but it's really time. And our FDA, whoever's running that, I've never even seen them, have really conspired to make it so that our country is a very uncertain place. And they've really hurt us. And these organizations, I believe, if they, I mean, I'm not a Trumpist, but Trump would have fired these people.
Yep.
And Trump would have been right. And he was anti-vax, basically. He took it. But I never saw him that pro-vax. But just because of the incoherence of our government. But, because, you know, the media doesn't want to attack the FDA. But I think the FDA is the worst I've ever seen it. They approve an Alzheimer's drug that, frankly, has very little efficacy. And the panel said 10-0, don't approve it. And they won't approve a vaccine that has clearly helped almost a billion people. They approved the J&J. Maybe they should just approve the Moderna. But I'm aghast that it's the government this time that's causing the problem, not the people.
Yeah. Well, Jim Cramer, mugged by reality. Hopefully that will engender more people to be mugged by reality. I'm aghast that the government has done it this time. The government does it almost every time.
I know. They conspired to make it so that our country is a very uncertain place. That's so true.
Very uncertain and much less free. That was the missing piece of the Cramer commentary. But, you know, I'll take what I can get from people like him.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Happy birthday to the Woodson Center. Happy birthday, dear Woodson Center. Happy birthday. Where are you, Amy? Happy birthday to you. Not exactly a Marilyn Monroe quality, but that's the best we could do. Our friend Bob Woodson joins us now, celebrating the 40th anniversary of his Woodson Center. Bob, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
Yeah, sorry about the singing. Bob, you have been in the fight of generations for several generations now when it came to the expansion of the welfare state. And, well, civil rights, the expansion of the welfare state, the efforts to lift people out of poverty, the efforts to extend opportunities in education to people regardless of their income, and now curriculum and our understanding of America. This is the fight of this generation, the 1619 Project and critical race theory trying to resegregate America. I don't know if there's another way to put it.
No, it's the new racism. As I said in my writings, that America doesn't have a race problem, it has a grace problem. And so what we're trying to do and have is marshal the forces of grassroots leaders throughout this nation to push back and resist this attempt to really assault the fundamental values. For the grassroots leaders, this is not some academic exercise. Faith and family, and personal perseverance in the face of opposition and is fundamental to their survival. This is how they have overcome the brokenness in their life. As I said, 80% of our closest friends and are people with letters in front of their names, not behind them, that their biggest challenge isn't race. It's overcoming the challenges of life, of drug addiction, of failed families, and their efforts to recover is being interfered with by the race grievance industry, and they are using America's birth defect of slavery and Jim Crow as a weapon against this nation. And we are going to push back by allowing those in whose name the left say they are representing to speak for themselves, to say they don't represent us.
And that's what we've been doing, and we're just delighted to play a role in defending this nation's values and fundamental principles.
It's tough because, as you say, the left purports to speak in the name of those you're describing, and they're undermining the interests of those for whom they purport to speak. But when you have people like Joe Biden claiming, you know, the proponents of anything they oppose are advancing the new Jim Crow, as is the case with election reform laws in Georgia or Texas, it's tough to break through because they have, you know, so much firepower in terms of media behind them to drive that message, just as we've seen with the COVID policy. They just pound, pound, pound. There's no underlying presentation of the facts. There's no underlying, or there's no public debating of those who have a different viewpoint. It's just driving through every channel that they control this position that, for example, these election reform laws are the new Jim Crow. And it's just tough to pierce that, isn't it?
It is, but reality has an uncomfortable way of intruding itself. And the very fact that polls are now indicating 90% of Americans are against defunding the police, 80% of black Americans polled are against defunding the police, thousands of black mothers who lost children to urban violence are now coming together to join in partnership with the police. You're seeing liberal city mayors now reverse course and are now reinvesting in hiring of police. And so it's, as I said, reality has a way of intruding itself. And you're going to see that these failed policies are going to have the consequence of forcing them to change course.
Are you pleased?
But unfortunately, too many of the Democrats are willing to sacrifice, as someone once said, they're willing to sacrifice black bodies for black votes.
Mm.
That's what they're doing.
Are you satisfied? Are you encouraged by some of the pushback you are seeing on critical race theory curriculum around the country in school districts?
Absolutely. One of our members, Ian Rowe, who heads up our curriculum committee, lives in Pelham, New York, a small town outside of New York. He just got elected to the school board, and he ran against a slate. And we're seeing other victories of school boards around the country. In fact, we have had seminars, virtual seminars, with hundreds of parents and people fighting to against critical race theories, and they are achieving victory in on these school boards. So we're very pleased with the thrust of the movement so far to push back against it.
Yeah, and Mr. Woodson, you wrote an article in National Review that critical race theory shouldn't be banned completely because we should fully understand its weaknesses. Can you explain?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think if you're against cancel culture, then you can't use cancel culture technique to do it. No, we should encourage the teaching of it. That's what we do, communism or fascism. But we should oppose the implementation of it. That's where the illegality comes in. This is where the opposition should come, but not in teaching the theory. No, I believe the best disinfectant is sunlight. And when you compel some of these critical race theories to say, like in Austin, in Texas, in certain school boards, the academic performance of students of 40% are failing basic reading, and now they are spending money on critical race theory. The question is, how does it improve academic performance? And I think you've got to critical race theory in a position where it has to confront whether or not it is improving the conditions of students. And when you have that kind of measure, it can't possibly measure up.
You know, it's interesting you talk about how reality intrudes uncomfortably for the propagandists. And just an example of this, I think some applicability. The singer, this popular singer, Camila Cabello, she talked about Cuba recently. She's Cuban and Mexican. She said a lot of people think the protests are about a lack of COVID resources and medicine, which is really just the latest layer in a 62-year-old story of a communist regime and a dictatorship. For 62 years, Cuban people have been living under oppression. What started out as a socialist ideal of free health care, free education, food for all, turned into present-day Cuban people having to wait hours in line for at the grocery store to come in and find the basic staples like beans and rice are 10 times more than what the average medical doctor in Cuba can even afford. She goes on to talk about the absence of freedom of speech and people being disappeared, tortured, imprisoned for opposing the communist line. And so, I mean, you know, you can propagandize on these issues. You can tell people what they're seeing isn't real all you want. But at some point, the scales fall from even the most ardent supporters' eyes.
Yeah, and also I find that some of these extremists, I mean, when you look at all the money being spent on critical race theory in area school boards are spending millions of dollars, and what is the return on those investments? What is the return? And so, again, reality is setting in. People are really beginning to question. We had, when we released our book, Red, Black, and White, it sold out in a matter of just 2 weeks when we released our curriculum, the first three lessons of our curriculum. We had 15,000 downloads in the first week. The critical 1619 had 4,500 downloads in a year.
Mm-hmm.
So Americans are really thirst for the truth. As someone said, if we abandon fact-based truths, then lies become normal. And that's what the left is trying to normalize, lies. But we've got to push back against that. But it won't be done by just issuing proclamations or writing essays or whining about it. We've got to take it to the people suffering the problem, the parents, and let them speak for themselves. So what we're doing at the Woodson Center is arming parents and citizens with the correct information, that our essays document the fact that when whites were at their worst, blacks were at their best. We built railroads. We built our own towns, our own economic infrastructure, where we had $100 million in real estate assets in Bronzeville section of Chicago in 1929. We had 731 black-owned businesses in Chicago. In areas down that are economic wastelands. And so this was done under rigid segregation when racism was enshrined in law. And so the question is, how could blacks achieve these great economic and social gains under the worst racial conditions that this country offered? And our young people and our people are failing today in systems run by the own people. Most of these cities over the last 50 years have been run by black Democrats. And if race were the issue, then why are blacks failing in systems run by their own people when those same systems run under segregation prospered? But you see, these are the uncomfortable questions that people don't want asked. Instead, they retreat and say, oh, the problem is institutional racism. I don't know what the hell that is.
Yeah,
maybe white people have some kind of ray gun that they can remote control device, that they can ride past a black institution and point it there and cause black people to miseducate their own children. Maybe that's what we should be looking for.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really interesting you point out about the popularity of the new book, Red, White, and Black, Rescuing American History from Revisionists and Race Hustlers, how popular that was as soon as it debuted on Amazon, as well as the downloads, and compared to the 1619 Project, because it seems to me that, you know, you're employing the right strategy. It's sort of the sell to the masses, live with the classes strategy, the Walmart strategy, sell to the masses. Whereas the 1619 Project and critical race theory is really selling to the classes, and it is presented as much more popular, much more accepted than it actually is. It just happens to be a small cadre of people that have oversized platforms in our society. But underneath that, there's this revolt going on as you say, in part because you and other scholars at 1776 Unites are getting the truth out. So it's a very interesting dynamic. I like it. I mean, it's almost like a counterinsurgency in military terms. Bob Woodson, founder and president of the Woodson Center, celebrating its 40th anniversary. Congratulations again. The book, Red, White, and Black, Rescuing American History from Revisionists and Race Hustlers. Thanks as always, Bob. Appreciate it.
And thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You know, this is sort of an esoteric issue, but it's a good one that speaks to the regulatory state. It's only been like 5 years since raw milk sales were legal in Illinois.
Do you know raw that? Milk sales?
Yeah, raw milk sales. It's a real patchwork of laws in terms of the legal sale of raw milk in the country. And our friend Remy over at Reason Magazine did one of his excellent parodies, and he took up the issue of the legality of raw milk sales against the backdrop of, you know, the legal sale of drugs like marijuana. It's remarkable.
All units be advised, there's an 1154 westbound on Route 18. Suspect appears to be smuggling white lightning. Repeat, suspect appears to be smuggling white lightning.
Well, in North Carolina, way back in the hills, lived my old pappy and he sold him some milk. He brew white lightning till the sun went down, and then he fill up a jug and he pass it around. Mighty, mighty pleasing, pappy's cow squeezing. Shh, whoo, white lightning. But the G-Man, T-Man, revenuers too, were searching for the place Pappy made his brew. They were looking, trying to book him, but my Pappy kept not cooking. Shoo, white lightning. Several arrests were made as selling raw milk remains illegal to this day.
Ha, huh. And somehow our jails are overcrowded. Anyway.
Well, the next time you're out shopping, maybe take a look. Some people like fresh food better than cooked. Food sold raw happens all the time, though I'll concede there is a milk that should be a crime. Clowning for some reason, largely unpleasing. Shoo, just frightening. In a truly free society, there are some potentially dangerous activities. If you think our jails are crowded, maybe we should be allowing white lightning.
All right.
Hey, what are you arresting me for? I made oat milk. Oh, come on.
You'll be happy to know on this topic, as of this year, in their infinite wisdom, the General Assembly has legalized lemonade stands. Remember
oh,
the story about
right.
the little girl with the lemonade stand getting harassed by local health officials?
Right.
Now little children having lemonade stands on their front lawn. That's now street legal. You don't need to have a industrial kitchen in order to set up a lemonade stand. But this sort of regulatory overreach, it's a real thing. And the raw milk's a great example.
And if you look at the CDC recommendations, I mean, they tell don't let your dogs lick your face. Don't eat raw cookie dough. You know, don't smoke. Don't one drink for a woman, two drink for a man. It's just ridiculous because these new CDC guidelines are just that, a recommendation.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Cause they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat.
Yeah, how about a 10-year scholarship for student-athletes at college?
A what?
10-year scholarship.
A 10-year?
10 years. 10-year scholarship. It's not just enough to pay college athletes anymore, potentially, or allow them to earn outside income. A 10-year scholarship, this from a proposal from a professor of finance at Mississippi State University, Thomas Miller. He offers this. Here's how it would work. When students are competing athletically, they keep the 4 years of eligibility over 5 academic years. during this time requires student-athletes to take a minimum of only 6 hours, two courses, a semester. Those who need the time to acquire the academic skills necessary for upper-level college courses will have it. Those who choose to finish a degree in 5 years can still do it. During these five competition years, the scholarship includes tuition fees, books, room, and board. During the last 5 years, the scholarship includes tuition and fees only, a low marginal cost to universities. With some dollar equity in the process, students will value their educations and strive to complete them efficiently. The 10-year scholarship will allow colleges and universities to design academic programs valued by the labor market. Instead of getting a convenient degree, more student-athletes can become educated in a wider array of fields. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line, delay adulthood by another 6 years if you're a college athlete.
You set parameters. College is 4 years for a reason. So in that time, you can accomplish your goals, learn how to live on your own, hopefully learn something along the way, and prepare you to get a job in the real world. 10 years.
Well, 4 years, as far as I'm concerned, is a bit arbitrary, too. I'm not sure 4 years is required based on what college has become. I mean, the idea that college is this important reflective period of intellectual inquiry, that's just a lie in most cases, in most places. But yes, so going 2.5 times more if you're a college athlete, that's not going on to the pros, which is 99% of college athletes. The argument he makes is that the student athlete doesn't have the time to be a student.
Okay.
The average D1 athlete devoted 33 hours a week to sports-related activities during the season, according to a study by the NCAA in 2016. Anyone who argues that a college athlete gets a free education hasn't spent time living their daily schedules. College athletes endure hours of grueling practice, conditioning, injury rehab, and film study. Plus, there's coursework done only at a cursory level due to time constraints. Then most college student athletes also then thus don't have the time to prepare for life after sports. The current system fails them, but the 10-year scholarship provides a simple solution. They deserve a 10-year scholarship. Deserve, boy, that word again, deserve.
Deserve
a 10-year scholarship. So instead of, I mean, you know, well, I guess it would be slightly less in the outlying 5 years, but, you know, multi-million-dollar scholarship to be a Division I, well, I don't know, soccer player, lacrosse player, et cetera.
We went to college. We know student athletes, and they all had tutors. It didn't matter if it was rowing or football. The university provided tutors for them.
Well, here's the other question I would ask.
One-on-one instruction that we didn't get.
Is there evidence that student-athletes fare worse in the labor market than their non-athletic peers? I haven't seen any evidence to suggest that. In fact, student-athletes, particularly for the revenue sports, seem to do better, or at least as well, in part because of the relationships they make being a student athlete, right? I mean, people want to be around the basketball players and the football players and so on and so forth, or people that went to the same university. Oh, you play basketball for Northwestern? You played football for Iowa? You know, that's a credential. It's a door opener for job opportunities because of the affinity for college and college sports, right?
Right. We'd love to hear from any athletes out there. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
What does it mean to be an academic All-American then? You see that in,
right,
sporting contests all the time, but basketball games, football games, this standout athlete is also an academic All-American. I mean, 33 hours a week devoted to sports-related activities, that's not even a full-time job. And in the real world, there are people that, I don't know, devote 33 hours a week to their family plus have a full-time job or work two full-time jobs plus raise a family. This idea, to me, this smacks of more coddling.
Yep.
I don't know.
The
maybe
dumbing
I'm
down
being
of
too
America.
Hard.
No, it is. It's ridiculous. And they don't need it because they are enjoying what they do. They love what they do. That's why they play the sport. At least they should. Love what they're doing.
By the way, the whole thing, like, okay, so I'm going to go at the two classes a semester pace. Then after I'm done using my eligibility, I have another 5 years.
Oh, my God.
Well, what is the 5 years for?
I mean, never going to graduate then.
The only way you should be in school for that long is if you're going to become a doctor.
Right.
Chris in the Gold Coast, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. My school, Indiana University, did six classes a semester plus one to get out in 4 years. Basically, they made you, do a summer school or something like that just to get out in 4 years. And they paid all of their athletes. They bought them cars. They gave them free housing. Mm. I mean, the whole thing was a scam.
Probably shouldn't be buying them cars. Housing, I understand, but...
Yeah, well, the whole thing was a scam, and, that's been going on. That was 30 years ago when I went, so this is not news.
Right, and thanks for the call, Chris. This is a very stylized view of the college athlete. Now, of course, the talk about people getting cars bought for them by boosters, that also represents a sliver of college athletes, too, the very best at the very highest revenue sports programs and at the best universities, the universities that have the best football and basketball programs, for example. Isn't it illegal? Well, yes, of course, but we've seen these scandals, but I mean, again, that's not the lived experience of most college athletes, because most college athletes are not in revenue producing sports. They don't get that attention, and they're not going to be getting endorsement deals either. But it seems to me that there's also less time pressure, or less demands on their time, I should say. I mean, the demands because of the profile on football and basketball players is going to be higher than on the tennis player or the lacrosse player and so on and so forth, isn't it? I mean, that's just obvious.
Just reminds me of a story. Jeff Moe, remember I used to date him?
Oh, of course.
He was a basketball player at
Iowa.
Was
he before or after the competitive eater? I forget.
He was before, definitely before.
Yeah.
But he had a scooter that some booster gave to him, and he didn't want it. He's like, well, you can just have it. So I drove it around campus for about 2 years, and then he moved on. I still had the scooter, and he's like, no, just keep it. And then I got in an accident. I had to call the dealership because somebody tried to steal it, and they said, that's where our scooter is, and they came and picked it up, and that was the end of that scooter.
So it was stolen from the dealership?
No, they gave it to him. It was, quote-unquote, lent out, come to our dealership, make some appearances with other basketball players, and he never gave it back, and I guess I had it illegally, maybe? I don't know.
And then you said, well, wait a second, I'm Jeff Moe's girl. He gave me the scooter.
I didn't hesitate. I just said, here you go. Here's the keys.
Did you have Jeff Moe's Letterman jacket on at the time?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I drove around that all the time. Yeah.
You're like what was the blonde chick's name in Revenge of the Nerds?
I don't remember.
She winds up with the nerd, but she... never mind. Chris in Lockport, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, hey. My name's Chris out of Lockport. So basically, I do have a college... Division I athlete that plays volleyball. I won't say where, but my biggest concern now is knowing that all fully vaccinated, not everybody, but fully vaccinated people now that they can contract COVID. We're on the hook for paying for testing for my daughter now. So how does all this fall in line with the testing, knowing that these children that are kids or young adults are fully vaccinated can still get COVID? Why are we still on the hook for I guess COVID testing is my biggest concern going forward. Also, what these college kids are going through now is just, spending a lot of nights speaking to my daughter. She's crying. There's a lot of stuff going on here that's not being spoken about as far as, pressures and the coach want these kids to get the vaccine when they don't want it. So there's a lot going on to this, and there's a lot of pressures on these kids. It's just immense. My wife's heart's broken every night with this stuff. So it's just, it's tough stuff right now.
What sport does she play?
Volleyball.
Oh, volleyball. I'm sorry.
So the combination of what, like isolation on campus plus the pressures of, you know, comply with
they were told they were going to have to test. There was immense pressure from other kids on the team why they aren't getting the shot. It's just, you know, just trying to keep her strong and in her values. You know, it's just it's a tough time right now because they just want to give into it. And as a parent, I just want to make sure she's safe. And that's all. And I'm not, we're not trying to, you know, we're not anti-vaxxers. I mean, that's all. The other thing is, you know, we've done all of our vaccine. Anything they've required or asked, we've done. I'm not comfortable with this. I've done a lot of research on this. More people I speak to this, I think more people are waking up to what's going on here. But like I said, I mean, it's not a free ride for these kids on a Division I level. It's just not. I mean, I don't even going through this COVID stuff, even without COVID. I mean, there's a lot of pressures all the way around. So, thanks for listening to me.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Appreciate it. Good luck, Chris, with your daughter at school. No question. And the COVID layering is sort of a whole new category here. And as you said, the pressures on them both academically and now athletically with respect to their teammates, with respect to being able to play and so on and so forth. And that's a fair point. But I mean, he wasn't really commenting on this, but that's separate and distinct from this idea of changing 4-year full rides to 10-year full rides.
Right. That's
Will and Skokie.
Hey, how you doing? I went to DePaul undergrad, and that was years ago, and DePaul was all basketball. That's all they had.
Yeah.
And these guys, you had Greg Boyd, who played. He was in the School of Commerce, and the School of Commerce wouldn't cut him any slack as far as Ray Meyer is concerned. He was the shortest guy on the team, but he consistently scored every year. Meanwhile, you had guys like Corzine and Robenzine. I mean, Robenzine, he played for Kansas City for a couple of years, and then he got cut. And he had nothing else to do. I know the guy. He couldn't even read Dr. Seuss level, okay? And he just committed suicide because he had no place to go. There's no reason to have scholarships for sports. Scholarships are for scholars. Sports are not. Sports are sports, and they're good sports, but you don't put them to college. It's a free farm team for NFL and the WBA, and it's just they just aren't paying for it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, that's an interesting perspective. I mean, that's sort of the Ivy League culture, right? That's changed a bit, but yeah, it's sort of been the Ivy League culture at the D1 level. I don't know. I mean, obviously, Amy, you're opposed to that because you're looking to get your two kids, Peyton and Eli, full rides, I presume.
Well, you know, I don't know what sport they want to play. Russell or Eli wants to play basketball. That's not going to happen. And
why?
Well, because he can't. There's better players out there nationwide.
Well, he's only, what is he, a freshman, sophomore?
No, he's going to be a junior already. Can you believe it?
Little Eli is a junior already?
And 6'5", he's taller than you.
He's much taller. 6'5", so, I mean, what's the problem in this game?
No,
is he doing the Pete Maravich homework basketball drill?
Yes, you gave us the CDs.
So what's the problem with this game?
There's people that are stronger and bigger and more physical out there, but he still has room to grow. But my other son, he gets offers all the time because he plays offensive line and he's number one in his class. And but he doesn't want to play college football.
He's tied.
Oh, that's right, he's tied. But we might have taken care of that tie with a transfer.
Is the Asian kid leaving? Go to a better school. Yeah, it's not surprising there.
Yeah.
Tiger mom took over, probably.
Right.
So he doesn't want to play college football.
No, does not want to play college football.
He wants to break his mom's heart instead?
Yes. He might want to play college volleyball. But there's not a ton of money in that either. So I think you have a better chance with academics right now in certain schools.
And how big is he?
He's 6'6".
And like what, 230?
No, he lost weight. He's about 190 now.
You know, he's got to put on weight if he wants. But, yeah, okay. So he's lanky.
Yes.
College. I mean, you could get a full ride for college for volleyball. Right?
Yeah, that's a possibility. So we're going to go out next week. That's what we're doing. We're visiting colleges.
Well, just know that Will and Skokie is opposed to scholarships for your two boys.
Okay, thanks,
no,
Will.
No, I mean, it's an interesting
point. If Will wants to pay, you know, foot the bill, that'd be great, you know.
If Will and Skokie does?
Yeah.
We'll ask him next time he calls. Tom and Glen Ellen. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to weigh in on the 10-year scholarship. My boys played Division I lacrosse, and a couple of things to note. The the professor from Mississippi State who's saying that it's going to be nominal cost, I don't think that's necessarily true. When they were getting recruited, one of the things that they give you a big campus tour, the coaches would kind of roll out the red carpet, and a big part of their pitch was student tutoring, basically, and big facilities, and all the student athletes for the student athletes only. So they, would help these athletes basically make the grade with very nice facilities and dedicated time and dedicated student tutors. So, there's a lot of other costs involved. I don't think it's that easy, that like he's saying that. And the other thing in lacrosse, a big thing was called reclassifying in high school, where very popular, where they athletes would transfer from public schools to private schools and retake a year. So basically redshirting in high school level. So, that's going on as well. So these kids, and some kids out east would reclassify twice because prep school is very popular out east. So, how long are these kids going to be in school and in college? I mean, they got to get out and,
Yeah.
They got to grow up and get out.
I agree with the coddling, and some of it's just not right. So,
thanks for the call, Tom. Yeah, I mean, there's the issue of do the costs that get passed on to the poor schlubs paying full freight going to the same colleges, but even if you set aside the cost, I mean, just what parent wants their kid to be in college for 10 years?
For 10 years, I mean,
you want your kid coming out of college at 28 with a BA? I mean, what? Come on.
Don't they have to get out of college eventually, get married, and, get a job?
Not everybody
has to.
Not everybody has to eventually get married. I hate to break it to you.
Oh, wait, that's right.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. When we talk about the policy response to COVID-19, we mainly discuss the great expansion of government and, by extension, people's dependency on it. Well, for obvious reasons, when you lock down the world's largest economy, that's what you're going to focus on. That's sort of the ultimate regulation, isn't it? But that's not to say that underneath that, as people were trying to cope in this new reality, there weren't relaxations of government regulations that have proved productive, I guess, minor ways for people to try to retain some of their sanity. Looking at the glass as half full was C. Jarrett Dieterle, who's a senior fellow at the R Street Institute in D.C., and the author of the new book, Give Me Liberty and Give Me a Drink. I think the latter is implied in the former. For more on this, please be joined by Jarrett Dieterle. Jarrett, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Finding the silver linings in a year of lockdown, that takes some doing, but you've done it. There are some areas that it's worth noting. Regulations were relaxed, I should say, and it's an indication that maybe less government, not just in those areas, but more generally, would be better.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think if you look historically, most situations of kind of national emergency have almost always led to more power being gathered into the federal government. That's pretty much the history of our country, which makes some sense, obviously, but also has led to a lot of really, deleterious long-term effects. And so it's actually very interesting that with COVID, that wasn't necessarily what happened. It obviously, the lockdowns were a huge restriction that government put on, but it was amazing to me that there was even some examples of government actually kind of retracting and getting out of the way. And you saw that in kind
kind of healthcare with telehealth. All of a sudden, people were doing telehealth appointments, and a lot of governors adjusted those laws to allow people to do that. It's not you're not allowed to do every service traditionally via telehealth. You saw it also with you know, allowing sidewalk dining, for example. That's against most zoning codes in a lot of cities, and that was kind of waved away. But I think the greatest example we saw it in was actually alcohol. All of a sudden, restaurants were doing to-go margaritas, and people were getting beer growlers delivered to their door. And I think the government officials did a smart job, at least realizing that the best thing they could do is kind of get out of the way in those situations.
Yeah, best thing they could do is make sure people drink, are numb to what they're doing, yes. And that's the way that we can all get through COVID together. Okay.
Yeah, because to-go alcohol sales in Chicago are not going away, ever.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the amazing thing, too, is that some of the stuff, you know, once you put the toothpaste out of the tube, it's it's a little bit difficult to get it back because now that people have to-go cocktails, they're like, why didn't we have this always? Like all the panic, you know, attack about what it might lead to just didn't materialize. You know, not every street has turned into Bourbon Street, you know, in New Orleans.
Right.
It hasn't turned crazy. So it's almost like people can be responsible with the liberty they're given.
Imagine that. Yeah. Wow. That's a concept. Well, you know, the other thing, though, too, is that the relaxation of some of the regulations because of the political clout of some of these industries like restaurants, beverage industries, it also gave other sectors leverage to say, well, wait a second. If the restaurant can open at X capacity, or if the restaurant can do this, then how is it you're telling me my church can't have Sunday service? So, you know, it led to, frankly, litigation where part of the argument was retail stores like Walmart are open and this restaurant is at this capacity, but you're treating a place of worship differently. That's a violation of the Constitution, and some churches were able to get relief because of it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you even saw that within business categories, too. I mean, some states were allowing certain types of restaurants to open, but not other types of bars or restaurants. And so, yeah, I think there was a lot of kind of people saying, hey, let's treat things equally here, you know, and not kind of differentiate arbitrarily between different kinds of gatherings. So I think you saw that, you know, the church thing is one example. And I think you saw it also just even between business categories, even within one sector. It's just a lot of these, it's kind of what always happens with government. A lot of the distinctions are kind of arbitrary.
Well,
step back and think about it, you know.
Jared, there was a point in time in Chicago when our schools were closed, our churches were closed, but casinos and strip clubs were open.
It's one of those things that you kind of like scratch your head about when you think about, and I think that, you know, people kind of have looked at, you know, why did the restaurants get relief? And I think there's some good reasons for that. But then once you do that, you need to kind of look at how other situations are different, or are they not different? And maybe, you know, that means that there is a way to do it that's responsible. So,
well, I mean, you know, casinos and strip joints, I mean, so, you know, when you have a mob economy like Chicago does, it's all gambling and drugs and prostitution and so forth. I mean, you can't kill the golden geese, and those are the golden geese for Chicago. But it is interesting. We're seeing it play out right now too. Is Lollapalooza, which starts today?
It starts today.
I can't wait.
People are already getting tested on the first floor of your building, Dan.
So CDC mask guidance reversal, you know, and we follow the CDC, we follow the science, unless it involves or runs interference to like looting or voting or Lollapalooza. Then we got to have some carve outs.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was interesting, even within different kind of categories of festivals or even, you know, bars and restaurants, kind of what it was funny. I went to my local brewery during the pandemic, and I stood up for a second. I actually had a cramp in my leg. And as I stood up, yeah,
okay,
stood up,
Norm, like, get away from the bar for a second. Jeez.
Yeah. They made me put on a mask, and I was like, well, I'm standing at like my table, not like spreading this around anywhere. But yeah, no, I think that again, it I think that policymakers, it's somewhat inevitable they would have difficulty differentiating, but I think sometimes
you know, you need to consider what's going on. Another funny thing that happened with a lot of places that were allowing restaurants to start selling alcohol is that they said, well, you need to have food with it. And then they got into this like crazy like detail about what constituted food. Like California for a while was saying that salad didn't count as food. It had to be like a entree or a sandwich. And it's like, what are we doing here? Like, let's step back here and like think about what's actually trying to help public health.
Yeah, you need some protein.
We saw a lot of it.
Yeah, you need some protein with that salad in order for that to qualify.
I guess right. So.
Make sure you get a balanced meal with your booze. No, it's funny because this is sort of it's another lesson in economics 101. It's just different sort of rent seeking behavior that gets different sort of preferential treatment from the government, but it's sort of the same exercise. And it's really interesting because this is one way to organize an economy in a society is, you know, whoever curries favor with the political class. Another way is to say there's a set of rules and everybody must abide them. And the government's not going to put its finger on the scale for you or against you. But we just seem to be and I hope some people have learned that lesson, but I suspect that very few have.
Yeah, no, it's. I think it's one of the hardest lessons to inculcate into the minds of government officials, for sure. And it leads to a whole host of lawsuits and problems and difficulties, no doubt.
He is C. Jared Dieterles, resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute. The book, Give Me Liberty and Give Me a Drink. Jared, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Bandits over at Reddit took a time out from discussing Robinhood to bat around this video that went viral of an American Airlines employee telling a woman that she was no longer welcome on American Airlines, at least for that particular flight, because she was unruly to one of his employees, to a ticket agent or some such person. Ugh. Take a listen.
You called my employee a bitch. Completely uncalled for, inappropriate, you're not going to travel. We don't tolerate that crap with us at all. So you can find another carrier to fly. I'd suggest hear it. If you acted appropriate and weren't disrespectful, then I would let you travel. But unfortunately, you called my employee a bitch.
She called an American Airlines employee a bitch, and so she was bounced from the flight.
And he told her to fly Spirit. Oh, my God.
That was sort of.
Hello.
That was sort of funny. I would have. Wait, what do you mean? What does that imply about Spirit? What is it you're implying about Spirit?
Yeah.
It continued, and the predicate was she got chastised for, like, not having her mask on as she was approaching the ticket agent.
Oh, my
God. Don't lie, because you already did that once when you took the mask off and put a new one of yours on.
I was getting this out of my bag. Yes, I was.
If you don't follow our policy, it's a period end of discussion. If you don't want to follow a federal mask mandate, and then on top of that, calling a vulgar name to my employee, it's not going to happen.
So if you don't follow the federal mask mandate and then you call an American Airlines employee a bitch, then you're out. You know, the mask mandate thing, which is super annoying and without point, that was extended to what, September 15?
Yeah, but the CEO of United was on CBS Morning Show. I don't know what it's called. Gail King and her buddies.
Yeah.
And he said that he thought at the time, because numbers were low, that mask mandate's going to be lifted in September.
What but do you now think now?
312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
So this guy's being lauded like, oh, he's, you know, so professionally handled a Karen. You know, I don't know.
He sounds like a Karen, a male version of a Karen.
I agree. I mean, she shouldn't have called the employee a bitch, but.
But did she, though?
I mean, but.
Or
you know,
did she say, I think I have an itch in my back pocket?
Yeah.
What?
Well, and also truth is an absolute defense to slander. So, you know, these minders and, you know, it's been mixed for me on flights between people that like are doing their pro forma duties and people that are like really enthusiastic about if that mask slips below your nose, then sir, I'm going to call a U.S. Marshal.
I know. I hate that. Ma'am, up, lift it up more because my nose is not mask compliant, really. Because it sloops out, so it drops a lot, and I always get in trouble for it.
You've got the drop nose.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. The not complying with the mandate and then being unruly allegedly with the agent, that puts you out at American Airlines. Yeah, maybe I will fly Spirit. I don't know. I haven't flown Spirit, but I'm thinking about flying Spirit just to find out what it's like.
Like why? It sounds like it might be a little bit of fun, huh?
Exactly. You know, like you can really have a free exchange of ideas over at Spirit, which I'm all for. So I'll tell you what. I'm glad that happened. I'm sorry that happened to that lady. She missed her flight, or had a book on another airline. But it's good to find out about Spirit. Jim in Palatine, quickly. Hey, Jim.
Hey, guys. Good morning.
Hi.
It's been a while since I talked to you. Hey, listen, so my wife is a flight attendant, and I'm sure you guys have probably flown recently, but what the airlines have turned into are circuses and zoos. People don't respect any of the rules at all. So the fact that this woman couldn't follow it, even though it sucks, couldn't follow the rules and then start swearing, she becomes a hazard on the plane. And that's, I mean, we all see these videos that go viral. At least that person was doing his job.
That's true. Thanks for the call, Jim. We're up against it. But yeah, at least it didn't get to the point of duct taping her to a seat. I agree with that.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.